Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. From July 1940, after the fall of France, Germany turned its attention to Britain. The Battle of Britain is the story of the hard-pressed RAF struggling against an enemy which up to that point hadn't been stopped. Immortalised on celluloid in the 1969 film with the star-studded cast, Guy Hamilton's Battle of Britain is very much an Anglo-centric view. And, even nearly 30 years after the war, the narrative leans heavily on the wartime propaganda. Well, the story of the Battle of Britain is much more complicated, and that's not taking anything away from those men Churchill referred to as the few. In fact, in many instances, it makes their story even more remarkable. I think this may well be a topic that we come back to from time to time, but to start us off, we're going to look at those crucial summer months in 1940 from the German perspective, asking how did the Germans view the Battle of Britain and what was their experience? Joining me today is Douglas Dildy and Paul Crickmore, authors of To Defeat the Few, the Luftwaffe's Campaign to Destroy RAF Fighter Command, August-September 1940. Doug is a retired US Air Force colonel who spent 9 of his 26-year career in Western Europe and retired with approximately 3,200 hours of fast jet time, almost half of that, as an F-15 Eagle pilot. He attended the US Armed Forces Staff College and the USAF Air War College and holds a master's degree in political science. Doug has authored several campaign studies, as well as writing several articles covering the Dutch, Danish and Norwegian air arms defence against the German invasions of 1940. Paul is an aviation historian and former air traffic controller. He's penned numerous books, including a number on the SR-71, the Blackbird and the F-15. Well, chaps, thanks for joining me. Shall we start with the Luftwaffe? Obviously, they'd been in action in the Battle of Poland and then France. But I just wonder, pre-war, how was it intended that the German Air Force was to be used? Doug, do you want to kick us off with that?
The Luftwaffe was intended to be used just as it was, just as the world saw it used in Poland and then again in the invasion of France and the Low Countries. It was primarily tailored to support highly mobile panzer armies conducting breakthrough operations and then rampaging into the enemy rear areas. It also had a had two secondary roles. One was maritime strike and a ship operations. The other was strategic attack, which was primarily night bombing. The results of the invasion of Poland and the invasion of France were actually spectacular, supporting the ground operations as the panzers broke through the French lines and drove to the Channel coast, trapping the VEF at Dunkirk. To these ends, the Luftwaffe was very successful in its designed role.
Yeah, it's more of an adjunct to the army necessarily than a strategic bomber role. Is that sums that up?
Yeah, but from a military point of view, an organizational point of view, it was obviously an independent service, just as the RAF was. But it was tailored to support the army. I wouldn't call it an adjunct to the ground forces because the ground forces had no command authority over it. Jumping to strategic bombing, the primary bomber to be used for strategic bombing would be the Heinkel 111. The crews were trained for night bombing operations as well as day bombing because it was envisioned that for strategic attack, because of the enemy air defenses, those attacks against cities or large complexes would be conducted at night. They would use the same equipment, but obviously during a different part of the day. And so the training was entirely different. But that training was secondary to training for interdiction attacks against railroad networks, rail yards, because it was crucial for the German ground forces attack to be able to halt the flow of reinforcements or the repositioning of defensive forces to keep them from blocking the advancing Germans. So the Heinkel 111 was primarily during the day an interdiction bomber well behind enemy lines, and at night a strategic bomber.
Well, at the end of May, I mean, at the close of the battle for France, What was the disposition of the Luftwaffe? Are they still match fit, as it were, to take on, in theory, Britain? Had they had a pounding?
They had suffered serious attrition by that point, but they were more than capable of taking on the RAF at that point. But the British were not their enemies at the time. They had trapped the British Expeditionary Force, the BEF, at Dunkirk. They had driven the BEF's air component off the continent altogether, and they were operating out of bases in Kent. So the British were not their enemy. Their enemy was at the time, the primary enemy was France. The panzer attack drove along the right bank of the Somme and to the north of that, because the Somme River provided a great defensive shield for the German panzer and infantry forces that followed them, allowing them, as I said, to trap the BEF at Dunkirk. And then they arrayed the ground forces along the Somme for what was called Fall Rot, or Case Red, the final invasion of France that resulted in the conquest of France. The Luftwaffe at the time employed six air divisions, of which only two and sometimes a third were employed against the BEF. Primarily, the rest of the Luftwaffe forces were redeploying also behind the Somme River, preparing for the final invasion of France.
Did the Battle for France grind down the Luftwaffe? I mean, I'm guessing, you know, these guys probably come straight from fighting over Poland. You know, how much of a breather did the Luftwaffe need before it turns its sights on Britain?
Well, it needed a significant respite after the complete campaign against France, which didn't end until the 22nd of June. So the Luftwaffe was singularly focused on completing the destruction of France and securing their capitulation. I would have to check my notes, but I think the Luftwaffe lost something on the order of 25 to 35% of its forces in the Battle of France. You know, if you're aware of where the Battle of France ended, many of the units were deploying southward past Paris to complete the destruction of French armies. So consequently, on the 22nd of June, while we see a very depleted Luftwaffe, it's also very what in armed forces we call malpositioned. It was to the south of Paris primarily, and facing south, or advancing south, operating to the south. So it had to do a 180-degree, you know, reversal and acquire bases along the French Channel coast and in Holland and Belgium that would support the Heinkel 111, the Ju 88, Dornier 17s, the Stukas, the Messerschmitts 109 and 110s. So it took 6 full weeks for the forces of Air Fleet 2 and 3 to redeploy northwards and orient themselves for a campaign against Britain.
So, Paul, had the Luftwaffe ever planned or even modelled an attack against Britain?
No. In fact, the Luftwaffe had never actually planned an air campaign against Britain prior to the fall of France. But Luftflotte, or Air Fleet 2, did conduct preliminary command post exercises in 1938 and 1939 to see if such a campaign was feasible. And actually, the exercises showed that the Luftwaffe didn't have the capability to conduct a successful strategic air campaign against Britain unless it had air bases in northern France, Holland, and Belgium. And so, in actual fact, that was the major requirement for determining and a determining factor for the Nazis to go ahead and invade France and the Low Countries.
It's interesting that there's this British obsession with the bomber always getting through in the 30s. And you wonder if the Germans hadn't really thought about it, put much effort into thinking about it pre the war, who the British thought they were, whose bombers the British thought were going to get through.
I think, you know, the tactics, you know, that the British had developed were sort of on the basis of the bombers flying from Germany. And hence, with the advent of the Bultmann Paul Defiant, which, as you know, was a terrible disaster when it was pitched against the ME-109s, but that wasn't foreseen when the aeroplane was laid down. The idea was that there wouldn't be fighter cover because the fighters were all in Germany and didn't have the range. And so the idea was, it was thought back then in the mid-late 30s that, yeah, the Defiance would just be going up against bombers.
And it's quite all right for the RAF Fighter Command to take that approach, because as I mentioned earlier, the German bomber doctrine for strategic attack was night attack from bases in Germany. For day attack, they already knew. They were already quite aware. I mean, even the losses in Poland from fixed gear PZL P-11s really, in some cases, decimated, especially Dorner 17 formation bomber formations. So the Luftwaffe had learned early that their bombers required fighter escort, and their doctrine had prepared the fighter escort to be flown by the Messerschmitt 110, the Zerstörer. However, that airplane proved completely inadequate in combating other fighters. So for the once the Battle of France, the invasion of France was underway, then ME-109 units were required to escort the Heinkels and the Dorners. So the point here is that the bomber always getting through. Well, the Germans already knew that unless you flew at night, the bomber would not get through without fighter escort. And they had prepared to escort them, but that preparation, the Messerschmitt 110, was an abject failure. So that forced them to take what was traditionally defensive fighters, the 109, and have them fly offensive bomber escort roles.
Now, if you're attacking Britain, much, you know, I guess is subsequently made of the British air defences, the invention of radar and all this kind of thing. But how much did the Germans know about the British air defence system? Because it is a system that we had, isn't it, that we developed? It wasn't.
Absolutely. It's, widely known as the Dowding system, after Dowding, the boss of Fighter Command. And actually, the Luftwaffe intelligence was very aware of the RAF's strengths, bases it's used, the locations of the units. In fact, what we would they called the air order of battle. And in fact, the January 1940 update of the previous year's intel report called Study Blue proved particularly accurate about number 11 group's order of battle. It was less accurate regarding number 12 and 13 groups, which was largely conjecture based upon the RAF's known pre-war expansion plans. So they were not too accurate for those two groups. Their knowledge of Fighter Command's integrated air defence system, or IADS, was quite limited. They were aware of the coastal chain home radar network. They're also aware that 11 groups sector stations that vectored airborne fighter squadrons to intercept the incoming raids. They were aware of that link in the chain. But they didn't know how British radars worked, nor how the system used radar information to provide target location and direction and the estimate of the height and strength of the formations of the airborne fighters. They did know, however, that if they could destroy either end of that tail, the coastal radars or the controlling sector stations, then they would degrade the RAF Fight Command's IATs. And thus, that would then give them an overall advantage against the defending fighters.
You know, what struck me about reading your book was this air defence system is actually, it's sort of defence in depth, isn't it? Because the radars only actually look out from the country. Out to sea, don't they? Once you're in, there's a whole separate air defence system that's built around the observer corps, isn't it, as it goes in?
Well, it is. It's an interesting point that you raised there, Angus, because you're right. As soon as the German forces were feet dry and coasted in, then the state of technology at that stage could not see the aircraft. And it was dependent upon the observer corps literally using the Mark 1 eyeball and giving that information through a network of posts into command centres, which then went on to RAF Fighter Command headquarters, and then would then be passed through group and sector stations as to where the German raiders were. That's only one part, though, of course, of the overall solution to getting the fighters against the incoming raiders. The next bit is, well, how can the controllers, sector controllers, direct RAF fighters? Because, of course, you know, they were over land. They didn't have radar. And that's where this somewhat interesting system called Pipsqueak and Huffduff came on the scene. And basically, within a sector, there were 3 HFDF fixer stations. They were arranged in a triangle located about 30 miles apart from each other, and they triangulated on an airborne radio transmitter in the aircraft, which they called Pipsqueak. And that was usually mounted in the leader's aircraft. So the aircraft's TRD-9 radio was modified to transmit a second preset HF frequency through Pipsqueak, which is a piece of apparatus was called the master contractor. So each of the sector's four squadrons was assigned a separate 4 second or a quarter of a minute, basically, transmission time, which was synchronized with the sector's HFDS receivers and deconflicted with the sector's own three squadrons. So every minute, each squadron transmitted a 14-second, 1 megahertz whistle or squeak to the 3DF stations. The receiver stations triangulated on each Pipsqueak transmission once a minute, and that was then plotted on a fixer table and then relayed to the sector operations room via a dedicated landline, where it was then passed to the controller's general situation map and also passed up the line to group and fighter command headquarters. So that way, the controllers knew where the bad guys were, they knew where the good guys were, and they could affect an intercept.
To maximise what we had. So the opening phase of the Battle of Britain, its significance, what's the rationale behind the German opening phase? Because they do it in a number of phases, don't they, the Battle of Britain, from the German point of view?
So really what you're asking here is about what the Germans call Kanalkampf, which means channel battle. And typically the traditional Battle of Britain histories represent the channel battles as the opening phase of the campaign. But what our research into German sources determined was that Kanalkampf wasn't actually a part of the Battle of Britain per se. It was an independent maritime air campaign, which is stemming from a different strategy altogether. And that strategy was called Handelskrieg, which means trade war. And that was the strategic blockade of Great Britain using U-boats and Luftwaffe anti-shipping attacks to throttle Britain's seaborne lifelines, obviously an island nation. So if you could throttle incoming supplies, then you could then hope that the British would seek an armistice. But Handelskrieg was actually just one of six different strategic options that were being considered by Hitler in June 1940 for bringing about an end of the war. And the others were a diplomatic solution, which Hitler, in his crazy mind, thought that he could actually, having conquered most of Europe, could then go to Churchill and they could sort of come to some gentleman's agreement. Well, of course, that would never have washed with Churchill's government, and shows how far off the beam, you know, that Adolf Hitler was to even contemplate such a thing. There was an indirect approach entailing conduct of military operations against Malta, Gibraltar and Suez. And the idea of that would have been, again, sort of basically a strangulation to cut off supplies from the short supply routes that Britain would have been using from her possessions in the Middle East and the Far East to get supplies through. So that was another option. Terror bombing was another option, which Hitler was certainly, it was certainly on Hitler's reserve list, and which he kept in his back pocket as a last resort. Another option was to consolidate Germany's defences and basically just ignore Great Britain and hunker down, reinforce the continental, sort of the Atlantic Wall, as it came to be known, and assume a defensive posture, which actually Hitler would never do. And that left the other option, which, of course, was a direct assault. And that meant obviously a cross-channel invasion of Britain.
And if I could add, fast forward way ahead to the point of the failure of the German air campaign against Britain, of these six strategic options, Hitler really was left with only the indirect approach through major investment in the Mediterranean, especially with the Luftwaffe, and then of course Rommel's Africa Corps. From a strategic standpoint, this really was not a viable alternative or a viable long-term strategy, because all they would really do if the Germans were able to secure Gibraltar through the help of Spain, to neutralize Malta and to take Suez, basically locking out the Mediterranean for any kind of British supply lines. The British supply lines would simply go around the Horn of Africa and still flow to Britain, although it would take longer, of course, which would slow down the resupply, but it would not cause sufficient degradation in Britain's resupply from the colonies, especially, to have had a positive effect on the outcome of the war. So really, one of the things that the RAF Fighter Command achieved by defeating the Luftwaffe and precluding any kind of cross-channel invasion, like Crix mentioned last there, it forced them into an alternative strategy that really had no hope of winning the war either. So there you go.
The curious thing, though, that battle over the channel is one that the Germans win, though, don't they? They do essentially prevent the Royal Navy from operating in the English Channel.
That's true. They sure did. The Admiralty withdrew the Dover destroyer flotilla and closed the channel to convoys for several weeks until the true Battle of Britain began and the Germans quit bombing ships in the channel. So that part was a success. But channel traffic, for instance, for London, because most of the channel traffic was, of course, headed to London, either convoys coming all the way across that would have ships dock in London as opposed to Liverpool, Glasgow, but also for the coal to sustain the British industrial facilities in London, the train networks, the locomotives burned coal at the time, and steamships. So granted, they were successful in closing the channel, but what kind of effect at the strategic level did that have? It did not throttle the arrival of imports from Canada and the United States. I mean, only one-tenth of the shipping in the channel was actually sunk. 90% of the channel traffic was getting through, regardless. So the overall strategic effect convinced the Luftwaffe leadership that it would take until 1942 until the Luftwaffe was able to be successful, and the U-boats as well. Dönitz said the same thing. It would take till 1942 before they would be able to mount a true economically strangling blockade. Well, Hitler was not about to wait that long for a strategic success. And as a result, he opted for the direct approach, the cross-channel invasion.
Yeah, but if you're doing that across the channel invasion, preventing the Royal Navy from regularly operating is not a bad start point.
That's absolutely correct, Angus. It was crucial for the Luftwaffe to deny the Royal Navy freedom of operations within the channel, and they did that at the east end of the channel, at Dover. They were not so successful at the western end, at Portsmouth and Portland. In the naval bases along the Cornwall and Dorset coasts. So they closed one end, but they had not closed the other, and that's why Air Fleet 3, Sperla's command, concentrated so much of its attacks on Southampton, Portsmouth, Portland, because they knew that they had to eliminate the Royal Navy's ability to operate in that side of the channel as well. But don't mistake it, those raids to reduce the Royal Navy in the channel under Canal Camp were not part of a preparation for Operation Sea Lion, the invasion plan, because Operation Sea Lion hadn't even been planned yet. Hitler did not arrive at the decision to initiate planning until after Lord Halifax's radio broadcast that that just totally rejected Hitler's so-called appeal to reason. So C-Line didn't get, you know, a head of steam up, if you will, didn't get this. They didn't get serious about C-Line until the British government had absolutely rejected any possibility of a diplomatic settlement. So you can see that there were 3 weeks there that that canal camp was going on before Sea Line was, you know, a, what's the phrase, a gleam in Hitler's eye.
to support Sea Line, the Luftwaffe, you know, it is to get air superiority over the south of England. Now, we've laid out the British air defence system is obviously going to be a problem. So what's the Luftwaffe's plan to achieve air superiority?
It was basically known as a rollback campaign, which is kind of a it's a sort of army logic, if you will. And knowing that most of the Luftwaffe leaderships were former army officers, it's not surprising that they would take such an approach. The Americans and the British strategic air power thinkers generally worked from the inside out. Go deep, bomb their centers of strength deep rather than attack at the front and try to roll back. But that's what the Germans, that's what the Luftwaffe air fleet planners recommended, and that's what Göring decided to do. It was in the sense of this rollback campaign, the first stage, and you used the word phase earlier, that there's several phases of the Battle of Britain. The Germans used the word stage. And I think that's important, a distinction for us to use. Not that there's any difference between the two words, really, what they mean. But I think it's consistent if we refer to the British perspective as phases and the German perspective as stages. That way we know exactly what we're talking about. But anyway, for the Germans, for the Luftwaffe, the Battle of Britain was planned in two stages. And the first stage was to bomb all of the coastal airfields, the coastal radars, and other airfields, anything that could support an RAF fighter squadron, up to about a radius of 60 miles around London to the south, southeast and southwest. The Germans knew from campaigning all the way across France that all that a fighter squadron needed to operate from any reasonable airfield was bowsers full of fuel, a lorry full of armaments, a bus full of engineers, mechanics, armorers, and a telephone line to the headquarters to tell them to scramble. That's all they needed. And so any airfield along the coast or inland to about 60 miles radius from London was considered to the Germans to be a potential forward operating location, an FOL. And that's why many of the airfields that the Luftwaffe pounded in this first stage were not fighter command bases, were not fighter command airfields. The second phase was to bomb the airfields closer to London, which were primarily the number 11 group sector stations and other RAF main operating bases, such as Detling, Middle Wallop, and others, East Church, that were not fighter command airfields, but nevertheless, because they were main operating bases, MOBs, then they had all of the communications back to their respective command's headquarters for conducting very rapid response operations. So the second stage of the Luftwaffe's plan was to destroy or degrade the capabilities of those stations.
So how did this first stage go for the Luftwaffe? I think the regular narrative is that it was, you know, they did pretty well
They did rather well in that first stage. And a week of very heavy air attacks, severely damaged Tangmere, which is a sector station, forced the abandonment of the forward operating locations, or FOLs, as we call them in today's normal culture, Manston, Hawkage, Lymph, and Ford, as well as heavily damaging another six other airfields, allowing then attacks to get deeper inland, much closer to London. In addition to that, they really hammered the Chain Home radar stations, taking Ventnor on the Isle of Wight off the air for over a week. Also damaged the radar stations at Dover and other sites along the southeast coast, and they were temporarily put out of action on some days, which then disrupted the fighter responses, which enabled the Germans to cut in with those deeper raids.
And what's the British response?
They responded in exactly the prescribed way that the doctrine would have it, which was basically individual squadrons of Spitfires and Hurricanes being vectored to intercept the Luftwaffe bombers and dive bombers. And most of the time, Luftwaffe attacks at this stage anyway were on coastal airfields along radar stations, and they occurred very often before the defenders could even engage. In fighter versus fighter combat, fighter commands outdated formations, which involve very rigid tactics, resulted in heavy losses. Because the Luftwaffe had a more fluid finger four formations, they had half again as many shooters. So they would have six shooters in a 12 aircraft squadron, compared with British, we would fly in three aeroplane Vic formations, which would then give them only four shooters in a 12-plane squadron. So thus, the Luftwaffe fighter formations outgunned the RAF fighter squadrons on a 1.5-to-1 advantage during the initial contact phase. That resulted in losses of British fighters to the extent of there would be three that would be shot down for every one Messerschmitt. So that would give an exchange ratio of about 1.77-1 in favor of the Luftwaffe. And in fighter versus fighter combats, Germans consistently won the battle of attrition. But their aggregated fighter pilot victory claims of the Luftwaffe leadership gave them the impression, actually, that the Messerschmitts were actually shooting down 4.5 British fighters to 1.09. And on that basis, that gave the high command the satisfaction that they were sure that they were embarking on the correct strategy to bringing about the demise of a fighter command.
To be fair, even at 3-1, I'd be feeling that I was winning. It's quite a kill ratio, really, for the Luftwaffe, 3-1. Is that irrespective? I mean, do the Spitfires really make much of a difference, or does it matter? Is everybody's going down mainly due to the British doctrine being flawed?
One of the problems is, you know, in the heat of battle, people are overcounting, being credited where that was not necessarily the case. Obviously, the British were fighting over home territory. They had the advantage of forced landing, and that the pilot, certainly, if he wasn't injured in any way, was sort of fighting, you know, the next day, whereas the Germans did not have that that advantage.
I would like to also add that this exaggerated kill claims was not isolated to the German side. The RAF fighters were significantly, fighter pilots were significantly overclaiming the destruction of German airplanes in air-to-air combat as well. Probably not to that degree. I think the final, like for on Battle of Britain Day, the British pilots claimed like 3.3 for every one they actually shot down. So don't take that that discrepancy, if you will, between the fighter pilot claims on either side and the actual losses to be too significant, because in the heat of combat and the stresses and the fast-paced, dynamic nature of air-to-air combat, a fleeting shot at an enemy passing across your nose, by the time you get back to base, yep, that was a kill. The other aspect of that is that the losses are what's truly important here, not the claims, because you cannot win a battle of attrition no matter how much you claim the enemy airplanes have been shot down. It really has to do with how many less do they not have to come back at you again the next day.
Yeah. Now, I was slightly curious what the difference with the kill ratios for the Spitfire and the Hurricane. For the simple reason, the Spitfire plays such a dominant role in our in the British memory of the Battle of Britain, and I know that in many respects the Hurricane was very much well, the workhorse. How much was the losses, the failure of the plane versus the doctrine flying the Vic formation?
If you isolated the Spitfire's combats with Messerschmitt 109s and the results of those is tabulated by Peter Cornwell in a fabulous book on the Battle of Britain then and now. He has examined the German and British loss records and the individual unit and individual pilot claims, and he's correlated many, I would say 85% of the engagements between the two types of British fighters and the two types of German fighters, both the 110 and the 109. So because of Cornwell's great work, we have the ability to tabulate basically what in U.S. Air Force fighter pilot terminology is known as who shot John. So that's part of Paul and I's research was to examine Cornwell's data, verify it with our own research to ensure that, yes, those engagements took place over those locations at those times, and then draw from that the losses to either side. And then that results, of course, in what we in military terms call an exchange ratio. Now, the exchange ratio, without going back to my data, without pulling out notebooks, reams of tabular data, I think it's fair to say that the Spitfire's loss ratio to the 109 was 1.2-1, and the Hurricanes was almost double that, so that the average is 1.77-1. So the Spitfire is as great a machine as it is, and it's virtually identical in performance to the 109. One has an advantage over the other at various altitudes and airspeeds. So there's no pat answer to which one was the better. So they're virtually identical. But the extra 20% or 25% losses experienced by the Spitfire pilots, I think we would have to attribute to the poor tactics. Even though the Spitfires had the advantage of radio, ground-based radio control to the intercept, so they had he who sees the enemy first has a great advantage. Whereas the Germans were working beyond any kind of radar or radio control capability, and they were in no man's land. So they had to keep a sharp eye out for approaching RAF formations. So the RAF formations, by the design of the Doubting system, had the initial advantage. But once the combat was joined, the tactics worked against the RAF fighter pilots, and as a result, the Germans had the long-term advantage over the course of each fight until, of course, their low fuel lights were blinking on, and they had to beat feed back across the channel to keep from taking a bath, as they called it, or winding up in the RAF version of a Stalag. And you got to keep in mind, too, that of the RAF fighter makeup of the RAF fighter command, one third of the squadrons were Spitfire, two thirds were Hurricanes. So the losses of more Hurricanes to 109s than the ratio of Spitfires to 109s, that skews the numbers. And you can prove anything with numbers. You can boil these down. You can trade them around, and you can make either side look like the victor. When, as we will discuss later, I'm sure at the end, the true victor is the one who can achieve their objectives.
Well, indeed, it is fascinating that fighter on fighter, those fighter on fighter numbers. Now, presumably, that's why the British now changed tack and concentrate on attacking bombers, and I'm right saying they refuse to engage directly Luftwaffe fighters. How much is that a problem for the Germans?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right here, of course, Angus. The commander of 11 Group, Air Vice Marshal Keith Park, quickly recognised that he just could not afford to lose so many of his fighters to German fighters, and ordered his sector controllers to have their squadrons avoid engaging Messerschmitts and reserve them instead for intercepting bomber formation. This is another thing that Doug and I kind of learned, that Park was able and was aware of what the formations were that were crossing coast in fighter sweeps because of the RAF's Y service. And this is a service that I think has really, excuse the pun, got under the radar as so many historians because of the sterling service that these guys did. the Y service were intercepting both WT, wireless telegraphy, and RT, radio telephony. The fighters used RT, 109s, and so they were transmitting on RT, and the Y service was intercepting those transmissions, and so they could tell which formations or which units were getting airborne from their bases, and they would know, therefore, that they were fighters. That information was being actually pulled in and correlated at RAF Kingstown. They were then sending that information directly up the line to 11 Group headquarters. So that enabled park controllers to identify what, you know, the consistency of those formations, and that way they were then able to husband their fighter squadrons and keep them back in order to tackle the bombers rather than engage in these very costly, for RAF Fighter Command anyway, fighter versus fighter combats.
How did the Germans combat the RAF niggling away at their bombers and refusing to attack their fighters?
Yeah, well, and that's the really frustrating thing. They couldn't, you know, the fighters weren't there to fight. And this was a major source of frustration for Kesselring, the commander of Luftwaffe 2, and his fighter leaders. Yeah, it's the principal reason cited by German historians, and indeed Kesselring himself, as to why the Luftwaffe was unable to defeat the RAF and establish air superiority over the south of England. So Park's tactic was one of the two major reasons that the RAF defeated the Luftwaffe and won the Battle of Britain.
But it's odd, is that you always win by refusing to fight. So presumably the Germans do make some attempt to come up with a different tactic that that'll combat this. Is that why they changed to this idea of continuous raids?
They were, in fact, just as you pointed out, they were constantly looking for ways to lure RAF Fighter Command into fighter versus fighter engagements, because as a result of the inflated kill claims, they began to believe that that was the secret to winning this campaign. That was the key. They had fighter units simulate German bombers as far as their flight performance. By that, I mean their altitudes and speeds. And as it turns out, sometimes would use the BF-10s to fly simulating bombers, which, you know, put them at an additional disadvantage because they were already bad enough as it was. And so sometimes they would pair the 109s with 110 formations. But these were always fighter, what we in the Air Force terminology call fighter sweeps. And even those were not luring the fighter command into battle. The idea of continuous raids has really little to do with trying to engage British fighters. It has everything to do with attempting to reduce the losses of their bombers. Goring was very upset with the very high losses of Heinkel 111s and Dornier 17s over England, because we have to remember that Goring, he was ultimately a politician. Yes, he had this veneer of credibility as a World War One aviator, but he was really a politician, and his basis of his power in the Nazi regime was his Luftwaffe. In other words, he could not afford to lose the strength of his bomber command. So this change in tactics represents an attempt to limit and reduce and limit the bomber losses to something sustainable, not as hurtful. There are, generally speaking, from a military point of view, there are two ways of overcoming an IADS, an integrated air defense system. One is by concentrating your forces in point in time and overwhelming the defensive forces. The other is by saturating them, which is to have multiple formations spread over a wide front and in several series of attacks that will overwhelm the defensive forces over time rather than at any one point in time. So the Germans shifted back and forth, trying new tactics. I think we see in stage one, they attempted to concentrate their bomber forces. That failed. in terms of the bomber losses. Bomber losses were very high in the first stage. And then in the second stage, they attempted to do these more saturating streams of formations, bomber formations instead. In either event, it was unsuccessful, primarily because while it did reduce I'm now talking about the saturation tactics. While it did reduce the losses of bombers, it also reduced the opportunities for British fighters to engage them because they were saturated, meaning there were less engagements with British fighters, which worked against the overall strategy of attrition. If they're not going to come up and play, you can't shoot them down and win. So as a force preservation strategy, it was good. But to achieve their aims, it was not. So they were constantly having to change tactics in attempts to draw out the fighter command and have the kind of attrition warfare that they saw as the solution to the problem.
It's the Valhalla flight, so there must be an attempt to just sort of overwhelm in massive numbers. They're a huge raid, aren't they?
That is true. The two Valhalla attacks are overwhelming. They adopt the overwhelming strategy rather than the saturation strategy. But again, it's about the bombers, not about the fighters. The whole basis of the Valhalla was because they were going to be air division size, in other words, three bomber wings rather than just single bomber wings. They used a whole air division to attack the London East End docks, with two air divisions on the first attempt on the 7th of September and then a single air division on the next attempt on the 15th. And the Germans had never practiced or trained to use formations of that size, that immense size, hence they were called Valhallas. The whole strategy there was that becoming dissatisfied with the poor results of bombing sector airfields in Stage 2, Goring initiated a Stage 3 where London became the target in the belief that surely the RAF will come up and play to defend London, because the RAF and the government cannot be seen, you know, lacking in the defense of the capital city. So based on that logic was the shift to bomb London in an effort to draw up as many RAF fighters as possible. And there too, you see the result as far as that approach goes, where number 12 group begins supplementing 11 group with the so-called big wing. So in that sense, they were successful. They drew not only all of 11 group airborne, but these were supplemented by or augmented by number 12 group and number 10 group coming in from the flanks. But nevertheless, the attrition rate, the shooting down of RAF fighters, was not as great as the fighter pilots were claiming.
Now we also see the British, so they double the number of squadrons each sector controller controls, is that right? And that's something to do with Pipsqueak and Huffduff.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Angus. I said earlier, you know, Park's first decision, you know, not to play ball, at least on the Germans' terms, on a fighter versus fighter engagement. His second most important and decisive tactical decision was allowing controllers to vector twice as many fighters to intercept the Luftwaffe raiders, because previously British fighter squadrons had been intercepting German formations that were two or three times their number. So by doubling the size of the intercepting formations, the Spitfires and the Hurricanes were able to meet the attackers on more equitable terms. And this was very much tied in with Huffduff. You would have, instead of one squadron using one frequency, you would have two squadrons, one lead, but two squadrons. So therefore, you were doubling the amount that a sector controller could handle against an incoming raid. And it was actually this tactic, far more than the so-called big wing, that was really accounted for the Luftwaffe's morale-destroying defeat over London on Battle of Britain Day on the 15th of September. And it was the RAF's eventual victory during that final week in September 40 where Fighter Command's victories really began to outpace its losses.
Yeah, well, it's Battle of Britain Day is my wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Usually when I got married, I was calling it Operation Sea Lion, and then my wife never liked that, but you know, Battle of Britain Day would have been more fitting. Battle of Britain Day, it's a tremendous loss for the Luftwaffe. 20% of the attacking force goes. I mean, is that all a reflection of the British changing of tactics over the coming weeks, rather than the power of the Luftwaffe degrading?
I would have to say absolutely. Park's decision to pair squadrons and thereby use 8 squadrons to engage within a sector rather than just 4 had an overwhelming result in terms of the Luftwaffe losses on Battle of Britain Day. And the bomber pilots and crewmen, the ones that survived the return, they were just demoralized by seeing their wingmen and comrades falling in flames over the London East End docks, and then on the egress on the way home, scattered across the countryside of Kent. So they were demoralized. They had been told for the last, this is the 15th of September, for the previous 2 weeks, since about the 3rd of September, they had been told that by Goring himself, that the RAF was down to its last 50 Spitfires. And the Valhallas on the 7th of September were able to get to the target and do their job without suffering significant losses. But on the 15th of September, and the big difference there is Park's change in tactics, they suffered enormously. And this does represent the increasing dominance in the air, and you could call it air superiority. The RAF was achieving air superiority to be able to impose its will over the attacking forces and come away the victor in that place and time. That's air superiority. It's in that place and time. It's not a long-term effect, but on that particular day, in that particular location over the London East End docks, the RAF was able to significantly show the Luftwaffe that it was far from a beaten force.
So if we reflect over the Battle of Britain, from the point of view of the Luftwaffe, did they lose it? I mean, were they even fighting? From their point of view, were they even fighting a Battle of Britain? I mean, is the name very much British centric, or did they just sort of abandon their campaign as Sea Lion gets cancelled and Russia preparations for the attack on Russia build up? How do the Germans view it?
The Germans view it as a failure, not necessarily a defeat, but a failure. And let me back up just a little bit to say that on the 17th of September, 2 days after the defeat over London's East End, Hitler decided to indefinitely postpone Operation Sea Lion. So then, as you pointed out, you have to look at that and say, well, why did they keep bombing if the reason for the bombing had been canceled, right? So what this shows us is that the Luftwaffe had a great deal of trouble admitting defeat, and Goring especially could not bring himself to admit defeat. Again, he's a politician; his prestige is on the line. If he admits defeat, then he comes down a few notches in the Nazi hierarchy. So he did not want to admit defeat. He wanted to pursue the daylight bombing campaign, even after the reason for it had gone away. And, of course, that's when he really began to ramp up the night blitz, the night attacks, because he wanted to continue to bomb London to show his power, his Air Force's power. But for all practical purposes, as a military operation, it was a defeat. the German Luftwaffe commanders and historians attribute that defeat to the fact that they could not get the British to fight them, the British fighters. And then they abandoned the bombing campaign. Again, this is their historical look. Their 2020 hindsight has more to do with the onset of bad weather than their continuing high losses. But I think the results are in the facts and in the data. They suffered severe losses the last week of September and basically abandoned bomber attacks and used fighter bombers, the Yabos, to deliver pinprick attacks, not so much because they were effective, but because Goring could say, we're still bombing London. And he was not sustaining bomber losses because it was being done by fighter bombers. The last thing I'd say is to revisit the comment about the amount of losses do not determine the winners and losers in air campaigns. It's whether you achieve your objectives. Doubting when towards the end of stage two, we're talking now at the end of August or the first couple of days in September, he was seriously considering, because of the pounding that the sector stations, Biggin Hill primarily, Kinley and Hornchurch to a lesser, but not too much of a lesser degree, those three stations were degraded in their ability to control fighters or to sustain fighter operations from their airfields. And Dowding was seriously considering withdrawing number 11 group north of the Thames. If he had done that, would the Germans have achieved air superiority over the channel and over the beaches? Yes, because of the distance that the RAF fighters would have had to have flown from their airfields from the stations north of the Thames to reach the beaches. It would have been very similar geographically from a military strategic point of view. It'd be very similar to the RAF's attempt to support the evacuation of Dunkirk. The distances involved would have been about the same. So the ability of those fighters to be over the beaches challenging the Luftwaffe, whose Stukas would have been pounding the ground troops attempting to defend against the invasion, the RAF's ability to interfere in that would have been much more limited if they had to fly from bases north of the Thames. But fortunately, as Park has said in several writings, the shift of and of course is a traditional climax, if you will, or the point of view of the traditional Battle of Britain legend, is that because Goring elected to bomb London instead of his continuing to bomb his sector stations, he gave Number 11 Group a reprieve, and they were able to recover. All of that is true. Is an essential part of the story of the history of the Battle of Britain. So as a result of Doubting not moving, withdrawing Number 11 Group, they were able to continue the fight and force unbearable, unsustainable attrition of the German bomber forces, to the point where Goring, basically, he had to throw in the towel, so to speak, but didn't want anybody to know it.
Yeah, well... That seems like a natural place to finish. Thanks, chaps. Loyal listener, if you're interested in finding out more about the Luftwaffe's experience during the Battle of Britain, the book to pick up is To Defeat the Few, The Luftwaffe's Campaign to Destroy RAF Fighter Command, August-September 1940, by Douglas C. Dilley and Paul F. Crickmore. I'd just like to point out... In To Defeat the Few are a number of colourised pictures from the Battle of Britain. Even if you're not interested in picking up a copy of the book, if you see it on a bookshelf, have a flick through. I'm not always a fan of colourised pictures, but these are some of the best I've ever seen. I think it's because they're coloured in a colour palette of the film stock of the period. The result is they're very sympathetically done and just look superb. For patrons, there is a bit more of Doug and Paul discussing what they are up to and our feelings on colourised pictures. Not a patron? Head to patreon.com/ww2podcast to join the club. Well, that's all from me. I'm Angus Wallace. Thanks for listening.